A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive.
Today we are taking a really fascinating and I think often surprising look into something we use every single moment, language itself.
Mm-hmm.
We're diving into P.H. Matthew's brilliant little book, Linguistics, a very short introduction.
And it really gets to the core of it. I mean,
yeah.
Think about this for a second. If I say, I saw the man with the telescope.
Yeah.
You instantly know that sentence could mean two different things. Right.
Right. Either I used the telescope or he had it.
Exactly.
But wait, the words are the same. The sentence doesn't explicitly say which one.
Precisely. And that little bit of confusion, it shows we're all running this huge, like, rule-based system totally unconsciously. It's all happening under the surface.
Okay.
So our mission today, kind of following Matthew's lead, is to help shift you, the listener, from just being a user of language, you know, someone who speaks,
to being a more informed observer, someone who actually understands the mechanics, the cognitive side, the social architecture that makes that sentence about the telescope even possible.
And understanding that hidden structure, that's the real aha moment, isn't it?
It really is.
So why does this matter now? Well, because Matthews argues, and I think he's right, that language is probably the most complex, the most impressive thing the human mind produces.
Yeah, hard to argue with that.
And if we unpack how it works systematically, we get these incredible insights into how we think, how society functions, even into history. It feels like a shortcut to understanding ourselves almost.
And Peter Hugo Matthews, our guide here. While he was a very distinguished British linguist professor at Cambridge, he's really the perfect person for this kind of exploration.
Yeah.
He sadly passed away in 2023, but he left behind these foundational texts, especially on word structure, morphology, and sentence structure syntax. You might know his books, Morphology or Syntax.
Right. So he was a real expert in the nuts and bolts.
Yeah.
But he wasn't just like stuck in one era, was he? He saw some major shifts.
Exactly. He was, you know, deeply rooted in the classical linguistic tradition, but he also lived through and engaged with that huge upheaval, the Chomsky Revolution in the mid-20th century.
Ah, Chomsky. That must have given him a unique viewpoint.
It really did. It's a crucial, actually. It means he gives newcomers, people maybe just dipping their toes into linguistics, this incredibly balanced, authoritative perspective. He's not just pushing one theory.
Okay.
He manages to synthesize really complex, sometimes technical ideas with, honestly, remarkable clarity. He doesn't drown you in jargon, which is, let's face it, pretty important when you're talking about a science most people just associate with, like school grammar lessons.
Yeah, don't split infinitives, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. Which is not what linguistics is about.
Okay, so let's try and nail down his central premise then. It sounds simple, but it feels really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Language is systematic, it's rule governed, and we have to study it scientifically.
Mm-hmm.
And for Matthews, that means being descriptive, focusing on how we actually speak, right?
Yeah.
Not prescriptive, telling people how they should speak.
Precisely. Linguistics, in his view, is about observing reality, not enforcing arbitrary rules. It's a science.
So how does he map out this reality? You said he gives us a kind of architecture.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. He builds it up, starting small and moving outwards. The book is structured like layers, really, interconnected layers.
Okay, so micro level first.
Right. Starting really small with sounds, how we make them, how they're organized in the system. That's phonetics and phonology. And then, still pretty small, the structure inside words themselves, morphology.
Then we zoom out a bit.
Exactly. Mm. To the middle layer, the meso level, how we combine words into phrases, into sentences, that's syntax, and also what those words and sentences literally mean, semantics.
And then the big picture, the macro level, this sounds like where it gets really interesting.
Oh, definitely. This is where you get meaning in context pragmatics, how social factors shape language, sociolinguistics, the connection to the brain and mind psycholinguistics, and of course, how languages change over time, historical linguistics.
Wow, okay. So it's this whole layered system.
But the key insight, the core idea, is that this whole multi-layered thing is systematic. It's logical. And by breaking it down, we start to see these universal principles that seem to underlie all human languages, despite their surface differences.
Okay, let's dive into that foundation then. You mentioned Saussure earlier, Ferdinand de Saussure. This is where we really shift from being like grammar police to actual scientists, right?
Absolutely. This is fundamental. We have to grasp his distinction between lang and parole.
Right. Lang, that's the abstract system.
That's exactly. It's a shared grammar, the vocabulary, the rules that exist kind of collectively in the minds of everyone who speaks a language. It's the system.
Right.
Parole, on the other hand, is just, well, it's the actual stuff we say, the specific utterances, like me talking right now.
So parole is messy, individual.
Right. And Saussure argued that linguistics, to be a science, had to focus on the stable, shared structure, the lang.
Okay, so it's like studying the rules of chess,
yeah.
Lang, rather than watching one particular game being played, parole.
That's a great analogy, yeah. And if you focus on those rules, those blueprints, you arrive at what I think is Saussure's most profound insight. The arbitrariness of the sign.
Arbitrariness. Okay, break that down.
So any linguistic sign, think of a word, has two parts. There's the sound image, the signifier, like the sequence of sounds, da.
Leoji.
And then there's the concept it represents, the signified, the actual furry, four-legged animal.
Got it. Signifier and signified.
And Saussure's point is that the connection between those two is completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
There's nothing inherently dog-like about the sounds, da. It could just as easily have been glonk or fleep.
It's just convention. We've all just sort of agreed.
Exactly. It's purely based on social convention, which seems weird at first, right? Why wouldn't words sound like the things they represent?
Yeah, why not?
Well, think about it. If the link wasn't arbitrary, if dog somehow had to sound like a dog, language would be incredibly rigid.
Oh, okay.
The fact that it is arbitrary is what gives language its amazing flexibility. It means we can constantly redefine words, create new ones, adapt to new concepts, all through social agreement. It's why language changes and evolves so dynamically.
That makes so much sense. The arbitrariness is actually its strength.
Okay.
Okay, so language is this arbitrary but rule-governed system.
Mm.
Where do those rules start? Matthews shows they go right down to the sounds themselves, doesn't he?
He does. And this is where we get the difference between phonetics and phonology. It's a crucial distinction.
Phonetics.
Right.
That's the physical stuff.
Right. Raw science, how your mouth, your vocal cords actually produce sounds, like how you make a P sound versus a B sound. Physics and anatomy.
Okay. And phonology.
Phonology is about the system, how those sounds are organized and how they function within a specific language. It's about the pattern, not just the raw sound.
And the key unit there is the phoneme, right? Mm. This feels like a really core linguistic concept.
Oh, absolutely fundamental. Matthews uses a classic English example, the P sound. Say pin. Feel that puff of air after the P.
Pin. Yeah, there's a little puff.
That's called aspiration. Now say spin.
Spin.
Huh.
No puff. Or much less, anyway.
Right. Phonetically, those are two different sounds, aspirated P and unaspirated P. They're physically distinct.
Okay.
But in English, are they different phones? No. Because
yeah.
You can't swap them to make a different word. You can't say spin with a big puff of air and have it mean something else, or pin without the puff.
Ah, I see. So because swapping them doesn't change the meaning in English?
They're considered just variations. The technical term is allophones of the single English phoneme P. They're treated as the same sound by the English language system, even though they're physically different.
Wow. So English speakers are essentially deaf to a difference that might be crucial in another language.
Exactly. In a language like Thai, for instance, that aspirated and unaspirated difference does distinguish between different words. So for Thai speakers, they're two distinct phonemes.
That's mind-blowing. We're structurally blind or deaf to certain sound differences because our language system tells us they don't matter.
It really shows how powerful the abstract system is. Now, building on that, let's move up a level to Matthew's real specialty, morphology. This is the grammar inside words.
Inside words. Are they?
The key building block here is the morpheme. That's the smallest unit in the language that carries meaning or has a grammatical function.
Okay, give me an example.
Think of the word unbreakable. You can break it down, right?
Unmeaning not. Break meaning will break. And ethable meaning can be done.
Perfect. Three morphemes. Un, break, and able. Each one contributes something. Un and able carry meaning. Break carries the core meaning. Or take cats.
Cat is the animal. And this means plural.
Exactly. Cat is a meaning morpheme. Ace is a grammatical function morpheme. Now, Matthews draws an important line between two ways we use these morphemes. Inflection and derivation.
Inflection and derivation.
Okay. Inflection is basically grammatical housekeeping. It adds grammatical information without really changing the core identity of the word, like adding ed to walk. to make walked. It's still a verb, just past tense. Or adding es for plural.
Right. Doesn't create a fundamentally new word.
Correct. Derivation, on the other hand, does create new words, often changing the word class. Think teach, a verb, becomes teacher, a noun, by adding er. Or read, verb, becomes readable, adjective, with edible.
Oh, okay. So derivation is about word creation.
Exactly. And it shows that grammar isn't just about sentences. It operates right down inside the words themselves. Word formation follows systematic, creative rules.
Okay. So we've got sounds. We've got word parts. That brings us to the really big layer of structure, syntax, putting words together into sentences. I think intuitively, most of us feel like sentences are just, you know, words chained together one after another, like beads on a string.
That's a common feeling, yeah.
But Matthews really stresses this isn't right. Syntax is hierarchical. It's about constituent phrases nested inside other phrases.
It has to be hierarchical. Otherwise, how would we explain that ambiguity we started with? I saw the man with the telescope.
Right. The telescope example again. So the ambiguity happens because that phrase with the telescope can latch onto the structure in two different places.
Precisely. In the hidden structure, the hierarchy with the telescope can either attach to the verb phrase modifying saw, meaning I use the telescope to see him, or it can attach lower down inside the noun phrase modifying man, meaning the man was holding the telescope. Two different structures, same string of words.
Wow. That hidden structure is the key.
It is. And this kind of evidence is what supports the idea of generative grammar, which Chomsky famously developed. The absolutely stunning claim here is that our brains contain a finite set of rules that allow us to generate and understand a potentially infinite number of new grammatically correct sentences, sentences we've never heard before.
That's incredible. And we do this unconsciously.
Totally unconsciously. It's called our tacit competence. Every native speaker has this incredibly complex knowledge without being able to explicitly state the rules.
And the fact that kids just pick this up without formal lessons.
It's maybe the strongest argument for it. How else could they master such a complex system based on the messy, incomplete language they hear around them?
Okay, so syntax gives us the structure. But structure isn't everything. We need meaning, right?
Exactly. So we move outwards again. From the kind of sterile dictionary meaning semantics to the much more dynamic, messy, real-world meaning in context pragmatics.
Semantics is literal meaning. Cat refers to that furry animal. Pragmatics is different.
Pragmatics is all about the gap between what the words literally say and what the speaker intends to communicate in a particular situation.
The intended meaning, okay.
And this gap isn't random. It's bridged by shared social understandings and rules. One key idea here is speech act theory. It says that when we speak, we're not just uttering sounds, we're doing things with words.
Doing things. Like what?
Like making a promise, issuing a warning, making a request. If someone shouts fire, they're not just describing something, they're performing the act of warning. If I say, I promise I'll be there, I'm performing the act of promising.
Okay, I get that. Saying is doing.
And maybe the most important social rule governing this is H.P. Grice's cooperative principle. It's like this unspoken contract we all follow in conversation. We implicitly assume, unless there's evidence otherwise, that the speaker is trying to be truthful, relevant, informative enough, but not too much, and clear.
We assume people are trying to make sense and be cooperative.
Right. And this assumption is how we understand implicature.
Implicature. That sounds important.
It's the implied meaning, the stuff that isn't explicitly said but is understood. My favorite example. If I ask you, are you coming to the party tonight? And you reply, I have to study.
Okay. You didn't actually say no.
Exactly. Literally, you just stated a fact about studying. But because I assume you're being relevant, following the cooperative principle, I infer the implicature. You're not coming to the party because you have to study.
Ah. The meaning is implied, inferred, based on the context and the assumption of cooperation.
Precisely. Understanding language isn't just decoding dictionary meanings. It's an active process of inference, constantly calculating what the speaker likely means.
Yeah, that changes everything about how you think about conversations. It's not just words. It's this constant negotiation of meaning based on hidden rules.
It really is.
Okay, this is a lot to take in. Let's try and pull out some of the really big core messages that Matthews wants us to take away from this whole linguistic journey.
Absolutely. I think the first, and maybe the most socially important, is descriptivism. Matthews really drills this home. Linguists describe, they don't prescribe.
Drop the idea of good or bad grammar.
Exactly. He shows convincingly that all dialects, all variations of a language, whether it's standard formal English or a regional dialect or teen slang, they're all equally complex, equally rule-governed systems.
So variation isn't error, it's just different structure.
Precisely. And internalizing that fosters, or should foster, a huge amount of respect for linguistic diversity. It fights linguistic prejudice.
That's powerful. Okay, what's message number two?
The sheer scale of your unconscious knowledge. You, me, everyone listening, we walk around with a staggeringly complex grammatical engine in our heads, phonology, morphology, syntax. We know it all implicitly.
But we can't write down the rules.
Not easily, no. Linguistics, as Matthews presents it, is the scientific effort to make that hidden implicit knowledge explicit, to map out the system we all use without thinking.
And the third big theme.
It's about inseparable context. Language isn't some abstract logic puzzle floating in a vacuum. It's deeply embedded in and shaped by everything around it.
Like society.
Yes, sociolinguistic shows how things like social class, identity, gender, ethnicity constantly influence how we speak and how language evolves.
And the mind itself.
Right. Psycholinguistics explores how our brains acquire language, how we process it in real time. It connects to our biology. Language is this living system shaped by society, enabled by biology, and constantly, constantly changing over time.
Living system. I like that. Okay, to make these ideas really stick, Matthews packs a lot into short, memorable statements. Can we highlight a few of those core ideas?
Definitely. Let's frame them almost like quotes encapsulating the key principles. First, on the role of the linguist. The task of the linguist is not to rule on what is correct or incorrect English, but to describe the systematic principles that underlie what people from all backgrounds actually say.
Observation, not judgment. Science.
Exactly. Second, on that crucial idea of arbitrariness. The relationship between the sound of a word and its meaning is purely conventional. There is nothing in the sequence of sounds D's that intrinsically connects it to a four-legged canine.
Convention is key. That's what gives it flexibility.
Right. And third, reflecting that cognitive miracle of language acquisition. A child learns a grammar of immense complexity on the basis of fragmentary and limited evidence. The only plausible explanation for this achievement is that the child is born with a pre-programmed blueprint for language, a universal grammar.
Wow. That's the nativist idea, right? Language as a kind of biological endowment.
That's the essence of it, yeah. It positions language not just as something we learn entirely from culture, but as something our brains are fundamentally built for.
Okay, this is all fascinating theoretically, but let's bring it home. How can listeners, how can you apply this knowledge, maybe starting tomorrow?
Well, application one is definitely enhanced empathy and communication. Understanding pragmatics, that gap between literal words and intended meaning, helps you become a much better listener.
You can spot the implicature.
Exactly. If your friend says, "Oh, your new haircut is interesting," your pragmatic knowledge helps decode the likely intended meaning, right? And understanding descriptivism, that all dialects have complex rules, means less judgment and hopefully better communication across different social or cultural groups.
Makes sense.
Application two. Critical thinking and media literacy. Seriously, once you get the hang of semantics, literal meaning and pragmatics, contextual meaning, implicature, you have powerful tools to analyze how language is used or manipulated.
Like in politics or advertising.
Absolutely. Think about loaded language calling someone a terrorist versus a freedom fighter. That's exploiting semantics, the different connotations and references of words, or noticing how advertisers use implicature to suggest things without explicitly stating them. Matthews gives you the toolkit to deconstruct that stuff.
That feels really practical. And you mentioned technology.
Yes. Application three, understanding the foundation of modern tech. All those linguistic principles Matthews lays out, phonology, morphology, syntax, semantics, they are the absolute bedrock of natural language processing, or NLP.
The stuff that makes AI talk.
Pretty much. Every time Siri, Alexa, or Google Translate understands you or even misunderstands you, it's because it's running complex algorithms based on the very systematic structures of language that linguists like Matthews have described. Linguistics isn't just academic, it's powering a huge chunk of our future technology.
Okay, reflecting on all this,
Yeah.
what surprised me most, I think, was the deep humility that comes with true descriptivism.
Humility, how so?
Well, it forces you to accept that ways of speaking you might have unconsciously dismissed as wrong or lazy or uneducated are actually just as intricate, just as rule-governed, as the standard form you might use. They have their own complex grammar. It makes you respect all forms of human expression much more deeply.
That's a great point, yeah. For me, the most valuable takeaway is maybe the sheer holistic view it offers. Language is this incredible bridge.
Bridge between what?
Between the humanities and the sciences, maybe. It connects this deep biological capacity we seem to have for language, this universal grammar idea, with the incredible diversity and creativity of human cultures and societies expressed through thousands of different languages. It's where our innate cognitive abilities meet the world.
Our brains meet the world. I like that. So to wrap up, we want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to chew on. Consider a single word, like the word silly. Did you know that centuries ago, silly actually meant something like pious, blessed, or innocent?
Wow, really? Yeah. Pious? That's a huge shift.
Right. It underwent this massive semantic change over time. So the thought is, what does that slow, quiet evolution of just one word's meaning tell us about how our deeper social values, our priorities, maybe even our sense of humor, change and reshape the very fabric of our language? See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.